This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
For 30 years, Omega Institute has been the nation's most trusted source for wellness and personal growth. Visit eomega.org to learn more about our workshops and conferences. That's eomega.org.
Hello and welcome to Living Green. I'm your host, Meredith Medlin. In this episode, we're going to have a lively, provocative, and deep discussion with Paul Stamets, author of Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Save the World. This book is a 21st century manual for healing the earth and creating sustainable forests through mushroom cultivation, featuring mycelium solutions to water pollution, toxic spills, and other ecological challenges. In our show today, we're going to have a yummy mushroom tea filled with Paul's greatest adventures. We're going to learn about Daryl Hannah's visit to his mushroom farm, why billionaires are flying into Paul's hometown to invest in any company he starts, and why fungal intelligence provides a framework for understanding everything from string theory and modern physics to the structure of the internet.
That when the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago and coalesced out of stardust, the first organisms first appeared in the ocean. The very first organisms on land were fungi. They marched on the land 1.3 billion years ago, and plants followed 600 million years later. And if there's a united organization of organisms, otherwise called if every organism voted, will be voted on the planet or off the planet? I think that vote's happening right now. Unless we pay attention to preserving biodiversity, the very organisms that give us life will be destroyed. But I am a mycelial messenger. If anyone gets anything out of this, it's the role and importance of mycelium in nature. And there was a housewife in 1942 sent in a moldy cantaloupe to a military hospital laboratory in response to the U.S. government's plea to Americans to send your moldy fruit to this one location. From her moldy cantaloupe came a strain of Penicillium chrysogenum that produced 200 times more penicillin than the government had in any of their laboratories. Her strain led to saving millions of lives, and the Japanese and the Germans did not have penicillin, but the Americans and the British did. Mushrooms also have a very keen sense of humor. The psilocybin mushrooms are most often found in the Northwest around law enforcement facilities, courthouses, universities, and churches. So if you want to go find psilocybin mushrooms in the Northwest, go to your local sheriff's department.
Welcome, Paul.
Oh, thank you, Meredith. Great introduction.
All right. So let's just get something straight right off the top. You, in the late 70s, you got a license from the DEA, and you studied psilocybin mushrooms.
That's correct. I was covered by a DEA license. My professor, Dr. Michael Bugue, had it, and I was listed on the license as one of the researchers. I was fascinated by the psilocybin mushrooms and did a lot of work with the electron microscope and was a significant contributor to Dr. Gaston Guzman's monograph on the genus Psilocybe, which is a world monograph, and in that genus, the majority of psilocybin active species. I have named four species in that genus to date that still survive in the scientific literature. Sometimes when you name species, they're thrown out later by other mycologists. I'm happy to say that after 25 years, they still stand as being valid species. And this led me into cultivation, and then as my horizons broadened, I started to become very interested in growing other types of mushrooms, non-psychoactive ones. My mother was happy about that. I started getting into gourmet and medicinal mushrooms, and that's really opened up a whole new arena. And the more that I studied the subjects, the more I realized I didn't know and how much more there is to know. And there's a wealth of knowledge inherent within fungi that we're just beginning to learn about.
Yes, indeed. It's been really fun researching you for this interview. For those of you who would like a little more background on Paul as we continue, he's been a mycologist and a mushroom enthusiast since the late 70s. He's pioneered tons of things as it relates to edible mushrooms, credited, like you said, with the discovery of 4 mushroom species. You've got 6 books now. You speak on conferences all over the world. You have a very, very deep vision of what an interconnected world environment looks like. And also the underlying thing that I've understood is that you really believe fungi can solve our world's problems. In fact, I've read that you've been saying mushrooms will save the world, and you also coined the term mycoremediation to describe the use of fungus to clean up environmental problems and absorb toxins.
Well, I've coined the word mycorestoration, which includes mycoremediation, mycofiltration, mycoforestry, mycopesticides, and the use of fungi to help stabilize ecosystems. What I think the kind of take-home message that listeners would benefit from is to realize that when the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago and coalesced out of stardust, the first organisms first appeared in the ocean. The very first organisms on land were fungi. They marched on the land 1.3 billion years ago, and plants followed 600 million years later. Now, fungi munch rocks. They produce oxalic acids and other enzymes and acids that actually will take minerals out of rocks and make them crumble. And there is at least 2 cataclysmic events that steered evolution on this planet. 250 million years ago, there was a huge asteroid impact, and when that occurred, enormous amounts of debris were jettisoned into the atmosphere. The Earth became shrouded in dust, the skies darkened, and sunlight was cut off from the face of the Earth. For years, decades, we really don't know how long. But because there was no sunlight, plants died, large animals died, not more than 90% of the species actually went extinct, and fungi inherited the Earth. The organisms that paired with fungi survived, obviously, because most of these fungi do not require light. And so life then again began to proliferate, and lots of species then evolved. And then we marched forward again until this is 65 million years ago, and bam, we get hit again. There's a recurring theme here, folks. And so again, with the second asteroid impact, the Earth was shrouded in dust, the sunlight was cut off, and fungi re-inherited the Earth. From those 2 asteroid impacts, that steered the cooperation or symbiosis of animals and plants with fungi. And so we exist today in collaboration with fungi. They are the construct of the food web. Fungi are the grand molecular disassemblers in nature, and they break down plant, animal, and minerals into soil. And so these are the great soil magicians of nature. And most everybody knows that the topsoil on the Earth is incredibly thin, and yes, it supports, you know, hundreds of billions of different species that live in the very top 6 inches. This thin skin that has given us life is greatly threatened. And as we lose biodiversity, especially with fungi, we begin to unravel the very food networks that have given rise to us. And even though we could be called an evolutionary success, I like to think that every organism on this planet has a vote. And if there's a United Organization of Organisms, otherwise called if every organism voted, will be voted on the planet or off the planet. I think that vote's happening right now. And unless we pay attention to preserving biodiversity, the very organisms that give us life will be destroyed. What is most unfortunate is that we are recognizing the role and the importance of these organisms as they are becoming extinct. And like rivets on an airplane, how many species will we lose before we have catastrophic failure? And I think that we are top-heavy right now from the evolutionary sense, and we're losing the very ground support network that has given us life. And if we're not careful, the role of nature is when a species exceeds the carrying capacity of its ecosystem, nature revolts. And I think we will see a viral storm in the very, very near future. And these viral storms are a direct result of loss of biodiversity and the efforts of nature to knock down the virulent organism, which unfortunately, it means us.
There's a lot of people who I've spoken with who are taking what you're saying very, very seriously. Big experts in the environmental movement. I've also, a lot of the conferences, LOHAS and other places I've been, even in the last 2 months, people, your name is out there and people are taking you very seriously. In our last interview on Living Green, Sarah Haynes, who's with the Spitfire Agency, she's working with Daryl Hannah to green the Virgin Conference or Virgin Music Festival that's coming up. Completely passionate. People are hearing about you through the grapevine. And one of the things I'd like our listeners to get out of this show today is a sound bite that you give them, or a few sound bites, about who you are and what your message is, so they can literally repeat that.
Well, it's tough for me to encapsulate it in one phrase, but I am a mycelial messenger. If anyone gets anything out of this, it's the role and importance of mycelium in nature. And unfortunately, the problem that we face in our society is, if you mention mushrooms, people think about portobellos or magic mushrooms. And there's a form of biological racism that has prevented science from using these fungi and the mushroom-forming fungi to our advantage. When people understand that the largest organism in the world is the mycelial mat, over 2,200 acres in size, and yet it's one cell wall thick, we have five or six skin cell layers that protect us from infection. How do these mats achieve the largest masses of any organism in the world and be one cell wall thick, surrounded by billions of hungry microbes per gram that want to eat this highly nutritious network of cells? It's because the fungi are in constant biomolecular communication with this ecosystem. They're articulate. They're inherently intelligent. We are born from fungi. 600 million years ago, we separated from fungi. Fungi are our ancestors. We respire carbon dioxide, so do fungi. We inhale oxygen, so do fungi. Our best antibiotics against bacteria come from fungi, but we don't have very good antifungal antibiotics because they harm us because of our close relationship. In the Journal of Eukaryotic Microbiology, a new super kingdom was erected 2 years ago called Opisthokonta, recognizing that fungi and animals belong to one super kingdom. So if we understand that the evolution of life on this planet, and we have fungal origins, then understanding how to use these fungi as our hereditary partners can greatly have a positive impact in being able to support life systems on this planet. Fungi move quickly, and I have lots and lots of examples, especially recently, of how important fungal biodiversity is. One example, I've been working with a BioShield program of the U.S. Defense Department, submitted over 300 samples. They've analyzed over 2 million so far, and one of my samples of mushrooms that comes exclusive of a species called Agaricon, Phomatopsis officinalis, comes exclusively from the old-growth forests of Washington, Oregon, in British Columbia, now thought to be extinct in Europe. This mushroom, exclusive of the old-growth forest, has within it very strong anti-pox properties, which include smallpox. The BioShield program has affirmed this. There is a vetted DOD press release. If you Google stamets and then smallpox, people can read it. And our research has further continued, and I'm bound by confidentiality agreements, but we may be navigating to a whole new class of antivirals. Now, if we lost our old-growth forests, if we lost the species that grows exclusively in that forest, as they have in Europe, and there was a smallpox epidemic, and after 1980, no one has been immunized against smallpox, and so we are extremely susceptible to a smallpox epidemic. If we had lost the biodiversity within the forest that has the species that potentially could fight smallpox, millions of lives would be at stake. And so we can't say now whether it will be clinically applicable, but all indications thus far are extremely positive. The BioShield program is funded with $4 or $5 billion, and they have some of the best testing protocols of any laboratory in the world, and we have passed all of their major benchmarks. And so there's also, if you don't mind me mentioning, there's a NPR.org interview with myself and a representative from the BioShield program and the former assistant director of the FDA, who founded the Bioterrorism Institute, all saying that my work with these fungi is exciting. It was unexpected, but this is what the BioShield program was set up to do, is to find find new medicines that were coming from unexpected sources. And so I make the argument we should save the old-growth forest as a matter of national defense. Most listeners may not know the history of the use of penicillin, and there was actually a housewife in 1942 sent in a moldy cantaloupe to a military hospital laboratory in response to the U.S. government's plea to Americans to send your moldy fruit to this one location. From her moldy cantaloupe came a strain of Penicillium chrysogenum that produced 200 times more penicillin than the government had in any other laboratories. Her strain led to saving millions of lives, and the Japanese and the Germans did not have penicillin, but the Americans and the British did. So that's an example of biodiversity. But this mushroom growing in the old growth forest doesn't enjoy the widespread habitat distribution that a penicillium mold does. It's restricted. We need to invest in our ecosystems. Biodiversity is absolutely critical to human survival, and nature, through hundreds of millions of years of experiments, has many great successes and how to navigate through many of the issues that we face today by looking back and looking towards nature to see the experiments that have been successful. We can gain a lot of tools that have been tested in the theater of evolution that are extremely helpful to us. And so rather than going to molecular modeling and great computers and being able to play God, which, you know, I know it incentivizes researchers and scientists because they can pull all these patents, I think it's much better that we go full circle and we look at the very habitats that's given us life and understand those complex interrelationships.
Thank you. We're going to take a break, and after the break, we're going to talk about more about mushroom consciousness and how it relates to string theory and what you think of the way the cells are mirroring what's happening with the internet. And we're going to get a little more into your belief system around how fungi is helping with the planet. So we're going to take a break now to thank our sponsors, and we'll be back right after this.
Omega Institute for Holistic Studies offers a wide variety of workshops and conferences in categories such as mind, body, spirit, health and healing, relationships and family, sustainability, and more. Visit eomega.org to learn more. That's eomega.org.
Welcome back. My name is Meredith Medland, and you're listening to Living Green. Paul, let's go right into your belief system. So I imagine this is a big belief system, and we have a short interview here, but what's different about your perspective on the planet that isn't being spoken about in regular circles in everyday conversation?
Well, you asked me to push the envelope here, and I believe that nature is intelligent. I believe that we are born of nature, and if we are intelligent, then by definition, nature must be, because nature gave rise to us. The structure of the mycelium mimics that of the computer internet. I first proposed this in the mid-1990s, that mycelium is Earth's natural internet. As you walk upon these membranes of cells, these are neurological landscapes that infuse all soils. They are sentient. They are aware that you are there. As you leave your footsteps, the mycelium reaches up and responds, grabbing newly available broken twigs or sticks, etc. And I think nature all around us is conscious of our presence. Whether we are conscious of nature's presence, of course, is a totally different matter. When I proposed that the mycelium is Earth's natural internet, I got a lot of flack for this, but I'm really happy that Dr. Nick Reed from Edinburgh and another group of scientists from Oxford came out with two papers this year looking at the mathematics of internet theory and then the structure of the nodes of crossing as mycelium grows. And lo and behold, using the same mathematical formulas, they found that through evolution, mycelium has optimized its nodes of crossing and the design of its networks to the same optimum that the computer internet theory also is seeking. And so those two graphs actually fall right on top of each other, and there's a series of astonishingly powerful papers that really supports my view. These are neurological landscapes, and we chose the route of going overground and encircling our nutrients and creating stomachs, and the mycelium chose the route of going underground and externally digesting its nutrients and then bringing in its nutrients through these cell walls. And so mycelium conforms to string theory, and the organization of matter in the universe follows strings of matter. And as we go further out in larger and larger dimensions, we see these same type of mycelial archetypes throughout nature. Networks are resilient. They survive from catastrophia. They're able to regrow and survive. And that is the way of nature. And I have the sense that we're part of this larger fabric. And we call it same self-recognition. When mycelium grows, it achieves fabric-like structures that gives it the ability to be able to navigate through very complex ecosystems. There's so many examples, and I've been fortunate in that, you know, this is my time. I am the mycelial messenger, perhaps. There's a lot of other, thousands of other people before me and thousands of other people that will come after me. My trust and belief in the deep intelligence of nature keeps bringing rewards that shocks people, that has been verified scientifically, that opens up many new opportunities. And I have the there are some things that are implicitly true in life, and I have to say that I think I've found a deep well of knowledge. And literally every day that I wake up, I'm happy to be alive because I know my life has meaning and I can save thousands of lives, if not thousands of species. Time is short. You know, we're going to lose 50% of the species in the Earth in the next 100 years of species that we know. What about the species we don't know? Over 90% of species in the kingdom of fungi are unknown. We only know about 10% of all the species that are out there. And so we have a little bit of knowledge, and the little bit of knowledge we have and what we know about it and how rapidly we're losing these candidate species means that we are losing tools in our biological tool chest. And I have a great concern that if humans don't get their act together, and this petty politics just is a bunch of cacophony that distracts people from the issues we should be really focused on. Frankly, I don't care about American Idol. Frankly, I don't care about the Republican Party. This is just a bunch of noise as a ship is sinking. We should be focusing 100% on preserving the ecosystems, because these ecosystems are our children's destiny. And I fear and I sense that children in the future are pointing and calling back in time, pointing the fingers at us, asking us, what the hell were you thinking? What are you doing? And there is a growing legion of micro-warriors, I hope, that are emerging around the planet to pick up this cause. And my book, Mycelium Running, you know, is a manual for the mycological rescue of the planet. It's a powerful book. It's one book, I think, in a series of manuals that people can use to help reverse course or change course. Because smallpox doesn't care if you're Republican or Democrat. Smallpox doesn't care about borders. You know, these viral epidemics are going to have a great leveling effect, politically speaking, because once they emerge out of the landscape, we're going to all have to work together very, very rapidly. And prevention is a lot better than treating after the fact. And every hour that we spent trying to prevent these viral epidemics and the loss of species from going down the toilet, frankly, there'll be time very, very well spent.
One of the things that I recommend that our listeners do is go to dhlovelife.com. That's Daryl Hannah, lovelife.com. And she interviewed you. There's a 5-minute segment on her website that's video, and she goes into your mushroom. I guess it's a farm that you would call it, right?
We have a large laboratory complex here, and we grow about 200 to 300 species of mushrooms. And I think in Daryl Hannah's video, we show about 8 or 9 of them.
Yeah, so that was simply amazing. And there's a key point in that video from the visualization standpoint that I think that our listeners would enjoy. And that is you lift up a bunch of wood chips and you show what mycelium is.
Anyone can go outside right now and find a piece of wood that's been on the ground and just lift it up and you'll see mycelium. Mycelium is a not-so-invisible landscape that is underfoot all around you at all times. And I propose to you that the mycelium is conscious. There is a consciousness there. And we need to engage these intelligent organisms for our mutual benefit. Now, whether you believe they are conscious or not, it doesn't really matter. See what they can do. You know, and the proof is in their activity. You know, we've been able to break down diesel and oil spills from 20,000 parts per million of polycyclic aramic hydrocarbons to less than 200 in 8 weeks, thus being able to clean up habitats. So they would rebound with all sorts of other organisms. Otherwise, they are anemic, biologically, nearly sterile environments, and extremely toxic. The fungi are the leading edge organisms in nature. Just as they came to land, the first organisms that came to land over 1.3 billion years ago, these fungi are edge runners. And being edge runners, they like interface environments. And as they go across a habitat, then they build food webs that support all sorts of other organisms that ride behind them. And so people need to understand that these fungi are extremely powerful environmental healers. And when we engage them purposely, then they can be fantastic allies for helping us repair the ecosystems that we have so severely damaged.
So should I go out and commune with the mycelium and sit with them? I mean, it makes me want to take psilocybin mushrooms and have a big conversation is what inspires me to do. But
been there, done that.
Yeah, I mean, but I guess for me, as you know, for my show, not necessarily that my interests represent all of our listeners, but so what I'm inspired because I hear you saying, all right, mushrooms definitely are able to heal pollution or contaminated soil, you know, so there's that element. There's the smallpox element. There's just the cool factor that, hey, we're losing a lot of our ecosystem. Let's focus on mushrooms. Sounds like a great idea. And this is a great conversation because it wraps in consciousness and nature and politics and oil spills in the environment. And I've been asking each of my guests to give an eco challenge that they can take on through next year's Earth Day. So in the next portion of our interview, what I'd like to do is talk to you about what we can do as, you know, I'm just living my life, doing my thing, and I'd love to commune with mushrooms and help get this story out, and I'd like to be able to have an eco challenge for myself and our listeners that would really let us be messengers for you and keep the mushroom consciousness alive in us. So we're going to take a break, and if you'll help me with that when we come back, that'd be really lovely. My name is Meredith Medland. You're listening to Living Green, and Paul, you've got an eco challenge for all of us.
Well, I mean, in order to get the most mileage from this communication, I would definitely reiterate that please get my book, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. There's a lot of information that it will, I think, convince people, even the people who are most skeptical. My eco or myco challenge would be for every listener out there to indeed go sit with nature and then explore with your hands, dig into the soil, smell the richness of the soil, and find these mycelial lenses that are all around you. Every mycelial lens outgasses fragrance signatures, and the forest ecosystems smell so good largely because of the fragrances of the mycelium that's outgassing. And understand these mycelial lenses and how vast they are and how many there are, and then to identify, if you can, target 10 edible mushrooms that you can learn how to identify. They're very easy. Morels are very easy. Shaggy manes are very easy. You choose, you know, the 10 most common edible mushrooms in your area, learn how to identify them, and then take children into the woods. And when you are picking the mushrooms, then show that the mushrooms come from this hidden, invisible network just beneath the surface of the soil, and that these fungi create the very soils that give us life. The mushrooms are like the tips of an iceberg. Unfortunately, it's the tip of a sinking iceberg as we lose biodiversity. But it's important that children are familiarized as quickly as possible that we live in symbiosis, and we are symbiotic communities. And even humans, we're just not one species. We're these large mosaics of microbes. And I may be speaking with one voice. This is the voice of Paul Stamets, and all the listeners may be listening in a sense as one individual, but in fact we are composites. And so it's my microbial community speaking to yours. And these fungal networks that exist in nature, not only are they a great example of networks and resiliency, but I don't think most people know that they're walking upon these things and they breed life, the absence of which, you know, we will have biologically anemic environments. I wrote Al Gore and Richard Branson. They haven't written back. But I wrote a two-page document on reversing global warming and saving biodiversity by investing in humus. When the mycelium is made of 90% approximately the mycelium, and mushrooms are complex carbohydrates, and they sequester carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And the mycelium, as it grows, these wonderful acid crystals called oxalic acid, which is two carbon dioxide molecules joined together. And so as the mycelium grows, not only internally does it have these carbon-rich compounds like proteins, but the cell walls are these exoskeletons that are extremely high in polysaccharides, carbohydrates. And then the mycelium is also producing all of these crystals that take CO2 out of the atmosphere. By investing in the fungal life cycles, we not only take CO2 out of the atmosphere, but we build humus. So the carbon sink and the carbon bank of soils is increased. And as soils are increased, they have a better carrying capacity of more biodiversity. And we reinvest then in ecosystems that can further support life. And the opposite trend, I think it will be obvious to any listener, is a form of ecological suicide. We are engaged right now in ecological suicide. And you put a dome over Shanghai, how long will that city survive? One day, maybe 2 days. You know, there are regions of this world that if you amplify them as an example of an ecosystem, there will be no life. Certainly life and not as we know it. And that's what I think is happening is there's a growing plague of deforestation that is occurring around our planet. And once CO2 levels hit 10,000 parts per million, all large animals will die off. And that trend is a trend that we're going towards right now. And I wish people would spend more attention to this issue than so much of the political cacophony that dominates the airways.
Well, you've got my attention, and I'll definitely be messengering as much as I can. So I really appreciate you committing your life to this. I mean, it's really wonderful to experience. It's just clear that that's who you are in the world. You've chosen your thing, and this is what you're doing. Before we wrap up our interview, there's two questions and things that I'd like to talk to you. One's a little more about mushrooms, and then the other is about your martial arts, about your black belt. I'm also a martial artist, so I'm a little curious about that. Before I ask you about that, Paul, a friend of mine told me about the recognizing mushrooms, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about what happens when we take the time in nature to explore mushrooms, what might happen to us?
Well, mushrooms can be invisible to the naked eye, and they can be right in front of you, and people just can't see them. There have been many times that I've actually sat down in the woods, you know, mushroom hunting and not being able to find mushrooms, and I'm sitting there quiet in the forest resting, and I look over, and the very mushrooms I'm looking for are right by my feet sometimes. I've had several examples of like that, and when you create this visual picture in your brain, and when you have this memory image, then you can then pattern your memory image across the landscape, and suddenly all these mushroom species will start jumping out at you, whereas before you did not notice them at all. Mushrooms also have a very keen sense of humor. The psilocybin mushrooms are most often found in the Northwest around law enforcement facilities, courthouses, universities, and churches. So if you want to go find psilocybin mushrooms in the Northwest, go to your local sheriff's department. It's a little bit of a problem, frankly. But, I mean, they have a very peculiar sense of humor, and it seems like the institutions that need them the most is where they tend to migrate to. Folks, I'm being absolutely serious. It's funny, but it's true. So, you know, mushrooms have appeared to me in the strangest of ways. There's a psilocybe species called Psilocybe sylvatica. Only two collections have been made in Washington State in the past 40 years. I was a starving student living at the end of a dead-end road, you know, A-frame with no power and no water. And one night around 11 o'clock, I felt emboldened to stand up, and I walked through the woods at night on the old abandoned logging road, and there was no moon, and I suddenly stopped, frozen, and I leaned down in total darkness, and I put my hand on top of the species that's only been collected twice. You know, over decades. Shivers went up and down my spine. It was too dark. I didn't have a flashlight. I pulled out my wallet, and I threw some paper on the ground, thinking that I'll come back, because what I felt like it was one of these mushrooms that I was seeking. The next morning, I came back, and there was a second collection of this species called Psilocybe sylvatica which means woodland mushroom, ever collected. How does that happen? I mean, how does that happen? The improbability of that is beyond mathematics, and yet it happened. So mushrooms have called to me, and I think they can call to many people. And if we seek them, they will find us more so than we finding them.
Well, I'm glad that I found you. We're going to wrap up our show today speaking a little bit about what it means to you to be living green, and give our listeners a sense of your spiritual practice, what your day looks like, what your connection to God, Source, Divine is, and if you would be willing, give us just a little intimate view into you, what we wouldn't get on the conference circuit or reading literature about you, but what is moving you throughout your day?
Well, my mother's had a great influence on me. I grew up in a highly charismatic Christian environment, and my mother is a charismatic Christian leader. She has a kind of a group of people that have built a vast facility around her in eastern Washington. My mother has raised a group of children who are very much scientists and who are non-charismatic in their belief system, but we inherently know that my mother believes in the power of goodness. And I had a great epiphany one day, and I'm always trying to build bridges between people on the far left and the far right. And this whole thing about intelligent design and the conflict with evolution, and I woke up one morning with this great epiphany, and I called my mother, who has a group of people who pray for me every day. Frankly, I like that. I'll accept all the good wishes that I can get. And I told my mother that I had this great epiphany. I wanted to share it with her because I think it's a bridge between people who think they're on polar opposites, but they actually aren't. And I made this actually into a bumper sticker, and it is, evolution is God's intelligent design. And I think that says it all, is that the mystery of nature is, and that of God is far greater than that which our minds, with all their limitations, can even begin to comprehend. And if we acknowledge that we are ignorant in the face of nature and God's complexity, then any interpretation that we have of God is inherently flawed, which doesn't mean that you can't be spiritual. It just means that as we struggle to understand the vastness of the universe, whether you believe in the one deity or whether you believe in nature, I think it's all one and the same. And ultimately, I think that the chasm between people who believe in nature versus people who believe in God will narrow. And indeed, nature and God is one.
Thank you for that. Listeners, if you'd like more information about Paul, or if you'd like to see some of the research I did prior to the interview, you're welcome to go to my blog, which is at personallifemedia.com. And if you'd like to email me and engage with me about what you think about all the different shows, you can do that at meredith@personallifemedia.com. And Paul, I just want to let you know that I will never look at a mushroom the same way. You've certainly changed my thinking around it. And if someone would have told me when I was young, I was always dressing up as Alice in Wonderland in costumes. That's I'm blonde, and that's a character I really identify with. So it brings me great joy and happiness to have been able to share this time with you this morning. Thank you so much.
Peace be with you all.
All right, thanks. Blessings. Listeners, for texts and transcripts of this show and other shows on the Personal Life Media Network, you can go to www.personallifemedia.com. And we're illuminating the psychology of ecology every day here on Living Green. Thanks for joining us.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.
Leave behind the busyness of everyday life. Visit the Omega Institute's website at eomega.org. Join the Omega Institute in celebrating over 30 years as the nation's most trusted source for wellness and personal growth. That's eomega.org.